for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, Iran dramatically scales back a nuclear program that could have led to a nuclear bomb. A victory for European diplomacy, or is it really all those U.S. troops in neighboring Iraq?
It's taken a lot to get a decision out of the Iranian leadership. There are so many different power centers that it's taken a crisis of this magnitude to get them to take a strategic national decision, which they now seem to have taken.
Also, airline safety. What's a passenger to think when the federal agency responsible for air safety fails to read an email about box cutters?
Corporate earnings are up, but will it translate into jobs?
And out of work and uneducated. One city's shocking statistics.
These stories and a Canadian sax player's love affair with Cuban music coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. President Bush is making a brief stop in Singapore today as part of his six-nation tour of Asia. While there, he posed for pictures with Singapore's prime minister. The president called the prime minister a good friend in the campaign against terror. Singapore has detained about 30 Islamic militants since 9/11 and sabotaged plans to blow up Western targets, including a U.S. embassy. Mr. Bush flew to Singapore from Thailand, where he attended the annual Pacific Rim Summit. The second day of testimony in the trial of Washington area sniper suspect John Mohammed is underway in Virginia Beach, Virginia. NPR's Ann Hawk reports after Mohammed decided to defend himself yesterday, a dispute arose today about the level of involvement of Mohammed's court-appointed attorneys in the trial.
After a handful of witnesses this morning testifying about their observations at or near the scene of the crime where Maryland resident Dean Myers was shot, Judge Leroy Millett conferred with lawyers on Mohammed about the role of his standby counsel, who prosecutors claimed were becoming too involved. You can have counsel or represent yourself, which means you fired your attorneys, the court told Mohammed. What would please you, Mohammed asked the judge. Mohammed's lawyers invoked the Brendan Sullivan Iran-Contra quote about being potted plants and said they were being as potted as they could, but would be remiss if they didn't discuss things with Mr. Mohammed. The judge said Mohammed was providing competent representation for himself and advised the defendant to move over a few feet away from his attorneys. Ann Hawk, NPR News, Virginia Beach, Virginia.
In Northern Ireland, the Irish Republican Army says it has authorized a third act of disarmament since the peace accord was signed in 1998. The statement is one of many by the key players in the peace process. Marianne McGuire has more from Belfast.
The Irish Republican Army says it wants to see all guns taken out of Irish society. It also says it endorses a statement made by the Sinn Féin president. Earlier, Gerry Adams said that a new context had been created in which there was a collective responsibility to implement the peace accord. He also said his party was opposed to the use of force. The IRA statement is the latest of a series of announcements that will help breathe new life into the 1998 Good Friday Accord. Earlier, the British government announced that fresh elections would be held to the Northern Ireland government on the 26th of November. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire. In Belfast.
A spokesman for the Transportation Security Administration says employees who monitor emails coming into the government agency will receive additional training following the arrest of a college student who admitted planting box cutters on planes. The student alerted the government to his plans by email weeks ago. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are down 21 points to 97.56. The Nasdaq is up 12 to 19.37. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, Microsoft is again facing government scrutiny a year after the company agreed to end its anti-competitive practices. The world's largest software maker is accused of using its Windows operating system to dominate the online music buying business. Justice Department lawyers and 19 state attorneys general have complained to a federal judge about a design feature of Windows that forces consumers who buy music online to use only Microsoft's internet browser. It also sends them to a Microsoft-owned website. A growing number of people without health insurance work for large firms, that according to a new study. NPR's Julie Rovner has the story.
Large employers, those with more than 500 workers, have long been the most likely to offer health coverage. The proportion of uninsured people employed by or in a family where someone is employed by a large firm is growing, according to the study from the New York-based Commonwealth Fund. From 1987 to 2001, the rate of uninsured workers in large firms rose by 57%, twice as fast as workers in smaller mid-sized firms. Researchers cited several factors for the increase, including a shift from higher-paid manufacturing to lower-paid service jobs, a decline in union membership, an increase in the use of part-time workers and others not eligible for benefits, and increasing health insurance premiums that prompt lower-paid workers to decline coverage. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Telecommunications giant AT&T doubled its third-quarter profit compared to last year's, but says its revenues fell more than 8%. The long-distance business continues to plummet as consumers continue to rely more heavily on cell phones for their long-distance needs. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces the music compilation Shake These Blues, the latest release in the I Heard It on NPR CD series at NPR.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
What the UN's nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, couldn't get done, three European foreign ministers now have done, persuading Iran to dramatically curtail aspects of its nuclear program to meet an IAEA October 31st deadline, after which Iran could have faced UN sanctions. Joining us on the line now from Tehran is BBC reporter Jim Muir with the latest. Welcome, Jim.
Hello.
Jim, foreign ministers from Britain, France, and Germany in Tehran today, a rare enough show of unanimity. What have they gotten the Iranians to agree to?
Well, it's a whole package, really, and I think the important bits which are new are the, Iran's unequivocal agreement to sign up to the additional protocol that would allow tougher international inspections, and also this announcement that it is suspending, voluntarily they claim, all activities in the direction of enriching uranium or reprocessing uranium. That is something that the IAEA had asked for, as indeed was signing the protocol, and the Iranians also announced that they would cooperate completely transparently and fully with the IAEA. So it's got three strands to it, very important, but they are things that have been had a huge amount of preparation going into them, including visits by Dr. Baradei, the head of the IAEA himself. And this is a kind of European supplementary effort, if you like. It's an important component in the larger process that the IAEA is spearheading.
Suspending the uranium enrichment program, of course, means that they are essentially suspending what the Bush administration accused them of, which is building toward creating a nuclear bomb. Now, the Iranians gave in. What did the Europeans promise in return?
Well, it's not really promises, at least not in writing. What's gone on behind the scenes, we don't know. But in the document that was agreed, the statement that was read out, the Europeans say that if everything is done according to the agreement, the Iranians should find it easier to get the technology and the supplies they need. In other words, the Europeans have given them assurances, whether you can call them guarantees or not, it's certainly a word they balk at, that provided they toe the line, meet all the IAEA's requirements, the Europeans will do what is necessary to ensure that Iran gets the technology and the wherewithal, including enriched fuel that it needs, to get its civilian nuclear power process going.
Now, Jim, the Iranians did say they would suspend the uranium enrichment program for an interim period. There are no timetables here. Are the Iranians suspiciously giving themselves some wiggle room on this?
I think they're giving them some face-saving room, that is what it is. I mean, they're basically complying with the resolution, which, in fact, they do not accept. The resolution itself, is, they say, is not acceptable to them, but they are complying with bits of it and the crucial bits of it.
This is a dramatic step, though, Jim, from your perspective.
Dramatic in the sense that it has actually happened. We've been waiting for it for a very long time. Yeah. They've been talking about accepting this protocol for so long. Now they're actually saying, we have decided to sign it. So it's very good after all this faffing around to get it actually in black and white that they're going to do it. And I'm sure they will now that they've said they will. It's taken a lot to get a decision out of the Iranian leadership because it's so fractured. There are so many different power centers that it's taken a crisis of this magnitude to get them to take a strategic national decision, which they now seem to have taken.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
Most welcome.
The BBC's Jim Muir. So why did Iran agree to suspend its uranium enrichment and allow inspections? Does the presence of 130,000-some-odd American troops in Iraq on Iran's eastern border have anything to do with it? Well, for some insight, we turn now to Joseph Cirincione. He's director of the Non-Proliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He joins us from member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. And welcome, Joe.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nice to have you. It's a fair bet, Joe, isn't it, that hardliners in the Bush administration will think that this is at least in part a result of their tough stance. You think so?
I don't think they have much of a case for that. If anything, the tough rhetoric putting Iran on the axis of evil and the invasion of Iraq has sped up Iran's efforts. They demonstrably accelerated their nuclear program over the last couple of years. I think the lesson they drew from the invasion of Iraq was that if they're going to find themselves opposed by the United States, they better get a nuclear weapon as quickly as possible. This seems to me to be more a victory for soft power. It was, after all, the visit of three high-powered foreign ministers from Europe who had linked expanded European trade with Iran to compliance with Iran's international obligations, and they seem to have scored a major victory today.
Huh. Well, given that, who do you think made this deal? Jim Muir referred in our earlier conversation to the kind of swirl of contending forces in Iran these days in its government. Would this have been a deal the hardliners made or moderates made or what?
Well, the Iranian nuclear program goes back decades. It was the Shah who started Iran's nuclear program. The U.S. sold Iran its first nuclear reactor. And the mullahs, the religious forces in Iran, have never been too enthusiastic about nuclear weapons. Some have railed against them as anti-Islam. The mullahs abandoned the program when the revolution took power in 1980. Ironically, the reformers seem more wedded to the nuclear issue than the religious factions. So you've got this debate going on. It seems to have been decided, at least for the moment, in favor of international cooperation, in favor of suspending the nuclear program, at least exploring this and see if Iran's non-nuclear future looks actually more secure than a nuclear one.
So who made the deal, the mullahs or the moderates?
I think the mullahs reined this in.
They're not interested in nuclear facilities?
Well, they're not giving up that option yet. This is still a temporary deal.
So you're saying that even within the Iranian government, confusing as the power channels can be, there are those who really sincerely may not have been building a nuclear weapon, as Bush administration officials tended to insist they would have to be.
Oh, I think the best way to look at this is that Iran was pursuing its nuclear options. We don't know if they had decided to secure a nuclear weapon, but they were certainly on that path. I myself don't think they had made that decision, but in another 1 or 2 years, they would have been in a position to build a nuclear weapon if they wanted to. So that's why this deal is so significant.
We began our conversation discussing the Bush administration's possible conclusions from this. Do you think there will be anyone in the administration who will say, well, this is a case where negotiations worked and not saber-rattling?
No. I don't think so. I think the administration is very skilled at spinning international events to claim credit for its theories, whether it's the report of David Kaye that found no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and yet administration officials claim that it vindicated their course of action in Iraq, or whether it's this event in Iran or events in North Korea. The administration officials are excellent salesmen for their point of view. I don't expect them to give any credit at all to the Europeans.
Joseph Cirincione, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Joe Cirincione is director of the Non-Proliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Officials of the Transportation Security Administration are promising to take more action on threats. Yesterday, a college student from North Carolina was charged in court with carrying concealed weapons on an aircraft after stashing bags of box cutters and bleach aboard four Southwest Airlines flights. Nathaniel Heatwall says he did it to prove weaknesses in the airline security system, and one is causing concern. Heatwall emailed the Transportation Security Administration last month, pinpointing the exact location of the planted box cutters and including his name and phone number. But the agency didn't act on the email until the bags were found by a maintenance worker last week. Well, joining us on the line is Sarah Gu. She's airline security reporter for The Washington Post. And Sarah, the TSA gets almost 6,000 messages a day. Could they have found Heatwall's email earlier?
Well, they said yesterday that they're now changing the way that they respond and review these many emails that they get every day because before, unless somebody said, I'm going to bomb this airport, they didn't really have a team to go in and investigate every single email. So now they are going to look at these more carefully. And I know that in the past they have been understaffed in terms of the number of people who actually look at these emails.
As it is, his email was titled Information Regarding Recent Security Breaches. So you'd think that would flag somebody.
You'd think so. What's really interesting in this whole story is that it took an airline mechanic fixing a clogged bathroom on a Southwest Airlines flight to start this whole thing. This mechanic, whoever he was or she was, is the one who initially found this first package just a month after it was been flying around the country on a Southwest flight, and that prompted this whole federal investigation.
Mm-hmm. Well, Heatwall, as we said, was arrested. Undercover agents for the Department of Homeland Security were applauded last week when they smuggled items into airports, including Boston's Logan, and there's been a huge outcry over that as well.
That's true. I mean, from the outside, it looks like this is really embarrassing to the TSA. But what they say in their defense is, hey, we're testing the whole system here, and we try to get items through security to see how successful we are, because that way we can teach our screeners how to be better. The problem is that from the public's perspective, we are never shown the results. They're never made public, so we have no real way to evaluate how much better these federal screeners that we've hired are compared to the private screeners who worked there before 9/11.
And in fact, we will certainly not hear about it when it goes well.
Right.
What's the status of other security issues? Let's broaden out a little bit and look at some of the others, including arming pilots.
Right now, as far the government doesn't want to tell us exactly how many armed pilots there are either, but they will say that there's several hundred of them flying around with their guns. And by next year, they expect that number to grow into the thousands. There is a huge interest level from the pilots in wanting to do this. They basically feel that they're the captains of their ship and they don't want another 9/11 to happen. And frankly, many of them say they have a lot of concerns about things like this with the Heatwall incident, that they don't feel security is 100%. They feel the cockpit door is the last stop and they want the ultimate last line of protection.
Mm. We'll get to the cockpit door, but do we understand that there aren't more armed pilots because of the training programs they need to go through?
Well, some of the pilots feel that they don't like the way that the training is done. They have a particular concerns over the way that they're supposed to carry their weapon into the airport, for example. And so they've taken those concerns to the TSA and basically been ignored. TSA wants to run this show, and a limited number of pilots, I would characterize it as, have some disagreements with that.
Mm-hmm. The strengthened cockpit doors, have they been strengthened?
They have. You know, right after 9/11, they just placed a simple metal bar behind the cockpit door, which wasn't really a whole lot. But now they've had to reinforce it with this material, and this is for all major commercial airlines, that really can't be shot through with a gun, and it's explosive proof to a certain extent. So it really is a different cockpit door than it was a couple of years ago.
And briefly, Sarah, in the few seconds we have, air marshals. Any idea how many flights they're on?
Air marshals have not increased in numbers in the last year or so, and they really only cover a limited number of the nation's daily flights, and the flights they are on tend to be going into and out of kind of high-risk airports.
Such as Washington, D.C.?
Such as Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. It's kind of obvious if you think about it, major airports, New York, L.A.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Sarah Gu covers airline security for The Washington Post.
Well, just ahead, we'll look at a blood infection that kills more people than breast and prostate and pancreatic cancer combined.
And later in the program, the economy. Could it be rebounding?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
It kills more Americans than breast cancer, more than colorectal cancer, more than pancreatic, more than prostate cancer. In fact, it kills more Americans each year than these diseases combined. It's the condition known as sepsis, not exactly a household word, but it's the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. And doctors are finally beginning to understand and learn how to treat it. Here and Now's regular health columnist, Judy Foreman, is here to tell us more. Welcome, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. The question, what is sepsis?
Sepsis is a nasty and complicated thing. It's basically an inflammatory response that goes amok when you get any kind of infection. And lots of little chemicals in your blood called cytokines kind of fire off and make everything swell up. They cause a lot of organ damage. They ruin your lungs. They mess up your heart rate and blood pressure. And your whole body essentially goes into overdrive. And you can die. Up to half of the people who get sepsis die, even in the best of hospitals.
So you mean from an ordinary household cut, you could go into septic shock?
You could, and people do. I mean, it's more often that it happens that it's an infection or a wound that you get during surgery. It happens more to somewhat frail and older people who have surgery and are already in the hospital. But it can happen to anybody with any kind of bad infection. Like I talked to one young man who had meningitis, and he went into septic shock from that and almost died.
How deadly is it?
Well, it kills 20 to 50% of those who get it. That's a lot of people, and that's in very good hospitals. Usually when you're septic, you are in the ICU, in the intensive care unit. But it has to be treated with great speed and great knowledge. And until recently, doctors haven't had all the drugs they've needed to treat it. Now they do.
What kind of drugs?
Well, there are better antibiotics, which can help if you're not too far along in the process. If you can kill the bugs that are starting the infection, you're better off. There's a new drug called Zygris, made by Eli Lilly, that attacks a number of the steps in the process of sepsis. And that works quite well, although there's some controversy about some side effects. But it's extremely expensive. It's $7,000 for a several-day treatment, which means that in some hospitals, people are having to ration the drug.
Zygris was also apparently marketed controversially.
To some extent, and it's also been a controversy because Eli Lilly, the manufacturer, is sponsoring this campaign. There's a public awareness campaign to make people know more about sepsis, and Lilly is sponsoring that. Personally, I think that's fine because people really do need to know more about sepsis, but it does raise the question of, is this just kind of a subtle form of marketing?
Zygris is extraordinarily expensive, $7,000 a treatment. How much better is it than previous treatments to be costing that much money?
Apparently, it's quite a bit better, but it's so expensive that its use is limited. Hospitals now find themselves having to ration it, and that's, of course, controversial in itself. Who gets it? Who doesn't?
So much better means that there's a likelihood or a strong likelihood that it will save your life?
Yeah. Some of the studies suggest that Zygris can reduce the death rate by about 6%. That's people with really severe sepsis. It does have some problems. It can cause abnormal bleeding. But it seems to help a lot of the problems along the pathway of sepsis getting worse.
6% is good. It's not, doesn't sound too spectacular.
No, but if you're on the verge of dying,
you want to be one of those 6%.
Yes.
What else can you do besides spend $7,000 for a single treatment with a drug that has really only so far led to 6% lessening of mortality?
There's a lot that you can do. Doctors have learned how to put in the ventilator machines, like to help you breathe in a better way with just the right amount of air pressure so that they don't destroy lung tissue that's already in the process of being destroyed. And they know better how to give steroids, which damp down the inflammatory response. They used to think that if you gave one big dose all at once, it was right. Now they give slightly lower doses, but for longer periods. And that really helps. So with Zygris and other drugs, there's a new antifungal drug. There's a new drug against Streptococcus. They're kind of chipping away at the problem. So 6% here, 9% there. I mean, they can make a dent in the overall problem.
Is there anything you can do to avoid sepsis?
Well, I think if you really start getting symptoms, you could not put it off. I mean, if you start getting a fever and really feeling awful and you've got some sort of infection, particularly pneumonia or what could be meningitis, you shouldn't delay getting to the hospital. I have a friend who, almost died from sepsis a year or two ago. And, you know, if you delay, you make it that much harder for the staff at the hospital to save you, because it comes down to minutes.
How many people a year are dying from this?
Well, they estimate about 750,000 get it, and 215,000 die of it every year. And it's going up partly because people are attributing the deaths more correctly. I mean, in the past, if you got a gunshot wound and you were septic in the hospital for 2 weeks, they'd probably put gunshot wound on your death certificate. Now they're being a little more careful in putting sepsis as the actual cause of death. So the numbers will probably rise just from that.
Judy Foreman, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
Judy Foreman is Here and Now's regular health columnist. To read her latest column, visit our website, here-now.org.
And these two notes from the world of sports. A county judge in Colorado has ruled that basketball star Kobe Bryant will stand trial for allegedly raping a 19-year-old resort worker. Eagle County Judge Frederick Gannett said yesterday that prosecutors had shown only a minimal amount of evidence against Bryant, but that there was enough for a trial. Bryant could face life in prison if convicted. And Boston police are in court today to ask for a hearing to determine if two New York Yankees should be charged with assault and battery. The possible charges would be in connection with that fight that broke out in the Yankees' bullpen at Fenway Park during Game 3 of the American League Championship Series against the Red Sox. A part-time Fenway groundskeeper was injured during that fight.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
You can send us mail the old-fashioned way. Mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, corporate profits are up, and some say it's going to last.
We really believe that the economy is picking up. There's, you know, the tax cuts, low interest rates, better growth abroad. All of those are coming together to finally create a sustainable recovery.
But shocking new statistics on the economy inside American cities, especially if you're young, and more so if you're black.
For black youth, the problem is twofold. They are out of school and they're not as likely to be in the job market.
These stories and more coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. The U.S. Senate is poised to give final congressional approval today to the first new federal restrictions on abortion in 30 years. Debate is underway on legislation that would ban a procedure that critics call partial birth abortion. California Senator Barbara Boxer says it is a sad day for women, noting the bill does not include an exception that takes into account the health of the mother. The House approved the ban earlier this month. President Bush has promised to quickly sign the ban into law. Massachusetts Congressman Ed Markey is stepping up his criticism of the Transportation Security Administration after a college student allegedly managed to sneak box cutters onto Southwest Airlines planes. Markey says Nathaniel Heatwell may have committed a crime, but he did not have criminal intent.
So I think the proper sentence for the young man would be to have him work for 20 hours a week at the Department of Homeland Security in the Transportation Security Agency so he can help them to respond better to the challenges of providing real security on our airlines in our country.
Markey sits on the Homeland Security Committee. Acting as his own lawyer, Washington, D.C. sniper suspect John Allen Muhammad withdrew a request today that might have allowed him to introduce evidence about his mental health. Muhammad is not pursuing an insanity defense, but testimony about his mental condition could be considered by the jury as mitigating evidence and a possible reason for not imposing the death penalty. Britain has set an election date in Northern Ireland, and that's prompted the Irish Republican Army to respond by confirming it has disposed of more weapons. British Prime Minister Tony Blair announced today elections for the Northern Ireland Assembly will be held November 26. That could pave the way for restoration of a Catholic Protestant administration for Northern Ireland. The elections had originally been slated for May, but Blair canceled them because of the IRA's refusal to keep disarming. Pope John Paul II today installed 30 new cardinals in a ceremony at St. Peter's Basilica. The diverse group from around the world includes only one from the United States, Cardinal Justin Regale, the newly appointed Archbishop of Philadelphia. Because of his failing health, the 83-year-old pontiff did not read out the names of the new cardinals himself. On Wall Street today, stocks are mixed. The Dow down 14 points, the Nasdaq up 15 points. It's 12:33.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Big corporations are posting their best earnings reports in years. AT&T and Texas Instruments today report profits double over the past year, and profits at UPS also went up nearly 28%. In addition, Treasury Secretary John Snow is quoted as saying he'd bet dollars to donuts that the U.S. economy will pick up jobs, 2 million of them in the next year. That's what
200,000 jobs a month. A positive turn in the road or irrational exuberance? Joining us on the line is Kathleen Madigan. She's an economist who writes the weekly Business Outlook column for Business Week magazine. And Kathleen, irrational exuberance, that's the phrase coined by Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan about the internet stock bubble. Some analysts say investors are buying stocks now in the same way they did in the late 90s.
Yeah, I think that's a little overblown, but certainly investors are back into the stock market after 3 years of just watching their portfolios decline.
Well, is it a bubble or is the economy really picking up?
No, we really believe that the economy is picking up. There's, you know, the tax cuts, low interest rates, better growth abroad. All of those are coming together to finally create a sustainable recovery.
Let's talk about where it goes from here. You mentioned tax cuts. What are the pluses and minuses if the tax cuts, as many say, are in large part responsible for this growth?
The plus is that we expect to see it for the next 2 quarters. It's not just the tax cut. In the first quarter, everyone's going to be filing their tax returns and getting bigger than expected tax refunds back, which we expect they'll go out and spend. But the downside of it is that we have a record deficit in 2003. We expect to have an even bigger deficit for fiscal 2004. And at some point, the U.S. has to pay this back. Hmm.
Give us a sense, too, about these third quarter earnings. That they were so far up compared to last year, just a couple more. Merrill Lynch up 50%. Intel doubled. Is that because it was so poor last year? Or, I mean, measure that growth for us.
You're right. I mean, part of it is because last year was so bad. But the other reason is that we had an explosion of growth in the third quarter. We think that the economy grew 5.5 to 7% in the third quarter. And the other thing is that businesses continued to cut costs over the past year, which improved their margins. But I would say that going forward, they are going to have to increase their profits by increasing their revenues, because we don't see how most companies can cut costs any further.
Well, and you mentioned the cost cutting. A lot of that means cutting jobs. When does growth begin to add jobs?
Well, this is where I'm going to disagree with Secretary Snell on that. I do think that we're going to see some job growth, but given the increase in productivity that this economy now generates, I don't see how we can get more than, say, 50 to 100,000 new jobs a month going forward. I mean, I don't know where he thinks this economy is going to create 2 million jobs a year from now.
And by the way, in that same interview, Secretary Snow also said that there would be a rise in interest rates, which concern many people in Washington because it's not even his place to say that. But do you think that will happen, interest rates rising, and what effect will that have on the economy?
Yeah, we do expect interest rates to rise, but just a little bit. It's a function of, one, the huge deficit that we're looking at, and also that economic growth is picking up, and that typically does increase interest rates a little bit, in part because bondholders think inflation is going to pick up.
If rates do go up, how does that impact growth, jobs, the whole picture?
Well, it's certainly going to slow housing a little bit, but that's been going so strongly, a little moderation won't be a problem. And for capital spending, we don't see it as a drag because businesses really look at the payout, you know, how demand is going, rather than the cost of capital.
Hmm. Well, Kathleen, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Kathleen Madigan, Business Outlook editor at Business Week magazine.
There's a new term for young people in American cities who are both out of work and out of school, and with no prospect of changing that, maybe ever. They're called disconnected youth. In Chicago, 26% of the population between the ages of 20 and 24 are disconnected, not in school, unemployed. For blacks, that already chilling number nearly doubles to 45%. Half of those African Americans out of work don't even have a high school diploma, which is equivalent to committing economic suicide, says Nita Fogg, who's co-author of a new study on the youth labor market in Illinois. Nita Fogg joins us now on the line. She's a senior economist at Northeastern University's Center for Labor Market Studies. And welcome, Nita.
Thank you, Bill.
Staggering numbers, Nita. Why?
I think, first of all, I would say there has been a neglect on our part of this population. Somehow, at this point, when these people are out of the school system, they sort of drop off our radar screen. we have neglected this crowd, and their situation has been getting worse.
Well, you say we have neglected this crowd. Where are their families? 46% of young African Americans out of work and out of school between the ages of 20 and 24. Who was raising them?
Well, that's another whole problem. There is a weakness in the whole institution of family in many of these neighborhoods. So these people not only are disconnected from school and work, but they are pretty much disconnected from any kind of social network as well.
Now, what year were these numbers from, and did the numbers surprise you?
These numbers are in April of 2000. Since April 2000, the employment rate for young people has declined by almost about 12 points in Illinois. The changes in the economy and the emergence of this service-based economy, what has happened is our job structure has changed so that we have lots of employment opportunities at the very upper end, professional, technical, managerial, what I call college labor market jobs. And then the middle is getting smaller and smaller, and then you have opportunities at the lower end. So because of that dichotomy in the economy, the fact that you're not engaged in school, you're not engaged in work, and you're not engaged, therefore, in investment in yourself, that leaves you further and further behind. So when I say high school dropout is equivalent to economic suicide, it's more so because of this economy. It shuts out. All opportunities are tremendously reduced if you don't complete high school. Even a high school diploma now is not as effective in getting you a middle-class standard of living like it used to in the 60s and 70s.
Do these numbers show up in other cities besides Chicago, where you focused at this point?
If you look at concentrations, there are concentrations in central cities, in large central cities, such as Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, and there are concentrations within these cities in high poverty areas and among race and ethnic minority.
Now, you do draw distinctions between blacks and Hispanics. Tell me about that.
For the Hispanic youth, the bigger problem is out of school. They're much more likely to be in the job market, whereas for black youth, the problem is twofold. They are out of school, and they're not as likely to be in the job market. So their labor force attachment is small as well.
So, Nita, what are the prospects for these young people?
I would never give up hope. Getting these people back in, reconnecting them to the school system, reconnecting them to training and employment is extremely important, because otherwise they're just lost.
Nita Fogg, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Nita Fogg is senior economist at Northeastern Center for Labor Market Studies and co-author of the study of Chicago's disconnected youth. She spoke to us from Boston.
Still to come, the Canadian sax player who found her muse in Cuba.
You're listening to Here and Now.
If you're left-handed, you know the lifelong angst of struggling with right-handed scissors, can openers, knives, corkscrews, the list goes on. You may also know that the Latin root of the word sinister means, you guessed it, on the left side. No pope has ever been left-handed, although presidents have been, including the first George Bush and Bill Clinton. And apparently cavemen have been southpaws as well. A French researcher says she's found a pattern of left-handedness dating back to prehistoric cave paintings. Charlotte Fowry, a pre-doctoral candidate at the University of Montpellier, joins us on the line from France. Welcome, Charlotte.
Yeah, thank you.
How did you even begin to think about left-handed cavemen?
Well, the aim of my research project is to understand why left- and right-handers coexist in human populations. And we knew that they have coexisted for a long time in hominids, but the study of negative hands was the first opportunity to quantify the proportion of left-handers.
What's a negative hand?
It's an outline of one hand that is resting on a cave wall, and it's made by blowing pigments through a tube held in the other hand.
We understand that the shamans did this, and so you were able to study these handprints, figure out which ones were left-handed, and then compare them to the general population. And it was pretty much the same.
Yeah, it was the same, but we don't know if it means that the proportion of left-handers remained constant. But it only means that it's the same now and at this time.
Well, what does this tell us about left-handedness?
Well, it tells that left-handers have always existed in human populations. So despite the cost of left-handedness, there must be also advantages.
Because otherwise you'd think man would evolve away from left-handedness.
Yes, because of natural selection.
But some would say that, and please don't write me if you're left-handed, but my friends who are left-handed say that it is often a disadvantage. You bonk elbows with people when you sit next to them, and, you know, there's all sorts of tools that you can't use, and they do see it as something of a disadvantage.
Yes, and also medical studies showed that there are some diseases that are more frequent in left-handers than in right-handers.
So it could be a fatal disadvantage.
Well, not lethal, but some diseases are just more frequent among left-handers than among right-handers.
Well, what are the benefits then? I mean, if it's something that's been around since prehistoric times, there must be benefits to it. What are they? Do we know?
No, we don't know. It's the aim of our research to try to identify these advantages.
Yeah. Charlotte, are you left-handed?
No, I'm not.
Well, why the interest then in this?
Well, I'm interested in understanding why polymorphisms exist in human populations.
Remind us, what's a polymorphism?
It's when there are different forms of a same trait, like people have blue eyes and others have brown eyes, and people are tall and others are small, like all the variability among individuals.
So in finding out about hands, you find out about a lot more.
Yeah, well, it's a way to understand how variability can be maintained in human populations.
Well, Charlotte, thank you.
You're welcome.
Charlotte Fowley, a predoctoral candidate at the University of Montpellier, joined us on the line from France.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
From the moment Canadian jazz saxophonist Jane Bonnet set foot in Cuba, she fell in love with the country, the people, the mood of the place, but most especially with the sound. That's Sweet Matanzas, Swinging in the Solar, from Jane Bonnet's recent CD, Cuban Odyssey. Jane and her backing band, Spirits of Havana, can also be seen on DVD in a documentary about her latest musical journey, which is also called Cuban Odyssey. Jane Bonnet now joins me in the studio to talk about the music and the island she loves, Cuba. Hi, Jane.
Hi, how you doing, Bill?
Great to have you here.
Thanks.
You first went to Cuba way back in 1982. You've never stopped going back. Tell us about your love affair with Cuba.
Well, I've been, like you said, going since 1982, and every time we go, we sort of discover something new. Often we're going on projects, a recording project, or organizing, a tour. And I also am very involved in working in the conservatories there. I do fundraiser every year in Canada to raise money for instruments and repairs and take technicians down to repair instruments. 25 conservatories in Cuba, so there's a lot of music schools.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But every place has a feeling, too. There must be something when you
province,
put that much into a place.
Yeah, I mean, if I was to kind of give a scope of it across America, I would say Havana's Manhattan. I would say Matanzas is, let's say, Chicago. I would say Cienfuegos would be like Denver.
And all those places very important because you've done several albums in Cuba, but this is the first album that you've done where you really ventured outside Havana.
Yeah, went into really some, for me, unknown territories musically. When we went to Matanzas, we worked with the group Los Muñequitos, which is one of the most famous, been going at least 45 years, Afro-Cuban folkloric groups. In Cienfuegos, we worked with a song group called Los Naranjos, and Camagüey with a group of Haitian descent.
Los Muñequitos, that was the song we heard right at the beginning.
That's right, Swinging in the Solar. Yeah.
Let's hear some more of the music on the album. You perform a traditional Cuban song, El Diablo, The Devil.
Mm-hmm.
That was recorded in a place you mentioned, the province of Cienfuegos.
Yes, that was at a Thomas Terry Theater, and that's a really crazy story. Thomas Terry was an American who was there in 1876. He was enticed to go there by a friend, and he actually bought a theater by nursing three slaves back to health and selling them. And that's when we bought the theater, and that's where we performed, and that's a very famous theater for the Cienfuegos.
Let's hear a bit of the song.
Ayer hablé como un hombre de diente de oro y me pienso casar. Ayer hablé como un hombre de diente de oro y me pienso casar. Rotas o fáciles vocablos o algo, estas figuras te van a embaucar. Cuidado, tenga hermanita, que si hombre es el diablo y te puede llevar. Cuidado.
The traditional Cuban song El Diablo, The Devil, performed by Jane Bennett. Try to be depressed when that's on. Now, of course, most Americans, maybe most people around the world, know Cuban music primarily from Buena Vista Social Club. Are you trying to create your own Buena Vista Social Club,
Not
Jane
really.
Bennett?
I've been creating my own
doing
since
it for a
1982.
Long time. That's right.
I see myself as a jazz musician working within the context of the certain rhythms or format of the music already. It's not really I'm presenting a group like Jane Bennett presents. I feel a little differently about what I do than what Ry Cooter does. I think what Ry Cooter has done is fantastic. You know, wish there was 100 Ry Cooters.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, one of the sad things is that one reason you've been able to go back and forth so many times to Cuba is that you're Canadian. Americans can't do that.
You know, this is a situation. There's no winners with this situation. It's a drag for the Cubans, and it's a really drag for many Americans that really have an interest to, you know, I feel like it's really part of America and an extension of America. And I think there's a connection between everybody. And it's just a shame that this embargo has just lasted so long.
The music in Cuba, partly because of the political situation, retains a certain purity, doesn't it?
It does. That is one thing, no matter how much you hate the bearded one, is that when he did come into power, the state set up certain facilities across the country for sports, for culture. Cultural institutions were set up so that the Cuban history and culture would prosper and develop and survive. And this is something that I don't think anybody who goes to Cuba does not notice, the pride and the history, you know, that the people have about their culture.
So many different moods on this album, too. It's not just that wonderful Cuban swing. The song Prison, for example, was performed in a cathedral. Tell us about who's performing it.
Yes. Well, this was the group Descendant I was mentioning. They're a 10-piece choir, 5 women, 5 men. And they got together because of the element that they all have Haitian background.
This was recorded in a cathedral where?
Yes, well, this is in a monastery, formerly a monastery, Catholic monastery, in Camagüey, where the group rehearses.
Si sense of the diversity on this wonderful album, Cuban Odyssey. That was Grupo Vocal Descendan.
That's right.
Yeah.
Nice pronunciation.
Oh, well. Just quickly, Jane, we should mention that, of course, one of the major players on this album, too, as so often in the past, your husband, Larry Kramer.
Right. I mean, he's
trumpeter.
He's a co-leader of Spirits of Havana, and we've been together, I guess, since about 1977, 78, and... he's been, he's my partner in music and cleaning up the house, et cetera, et cetera.
Partner in crime. Let's finish with a wonderful tune, A La Rumba. It features one of the first friends you made in Havana, someone people should know more about, the folk singer Merceditas Valdez. Tell us about her.
Well, Merceditas, boy, it's really, to wrap it up quickly, she was not only a great performer of the religious music, of the Afro-Cuban folkloric music, but she was also a very great popular singer, and she straddled both worlds. Similar to Celia Cruz, although Celia Cruz went more towards her career into popular, and of course...
And Celia Cruz left the island, of
course.
She
left the island, and she became super megastar, and Merceditas did not. And even in Merceditas' heyday, really, until the very end of her life, she started to get some recognition.
The poignancy of A La Rumba is you recorded it with her not long before she died.
That's right, yeah.
Cuando yo llego a la rumba, habanera dicen todos que linda viene. Conmigo quieren bailar para saborear el son que Cuba tiene.
A La Rumba, sung by the late Merceditas Valdez, who was a very close friend of our guest, Jane Burnett. Jane, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Bill.
It's a wonderful album. Jazz saxophonist Jane Burnett, her new CD and DVD with performances by the Spirits of Havana is called Cuban Odyssey. For more information and to find out their tour schedule, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Jordana Gustafson, Brad Fritz, Emiko Tomagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Boris Strapatsky. Our web producer, Zach Christo. Our interns are Ann Stevenson and Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
For Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
Planning for old age means more than stashing away some money.
And are you a mac and cheese or a mashed potato? Our resident chef offers comfort food recipes.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.